I'm going to present today on our, we did a retrospective file review on our first 100 patients. And I have to say, I really do enjoy coming here and seeing you all in these presentations, but I have to admit to you that all things being equal, this is really where I would much rather be. That's Prince and Emma, and that's us doing hay with the horses, and so that's what I really, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to farm with horses. But on to the boring stuff. The Department of Veteran Affairs, as you know from what Bart said, started to bring chiropractic in October of 2004. And Andy Dunn, who's associated with New York Chiropractic College, was actually the first chiropractor to be put in a VA facility, and that was in the Buffalo VA Medical Center. And Andy wrote, as Bart talked about the demographics of his patients, that the average age was 55, they were almost all male, main complaint was low back pain. Most had undergone some previous care, service-connected. In the VA, what happens is that if you're service-connected, it means that you're service-connected for your musculoskeletal complaint, then your care is free. And so it does matter whether you're service-connected or not. And actually, service connection and disability actually have a direct financial relationship for these patients. So for those of us that are in private practice, it would be very much like saying they have a an open workers' comp or no-fault case, which means that these are things that may affect our outcomes. And then Andy actually looked at who referred patients to him. And so almost all of them came from primary care in his. And then the background of our facility was that the way the original mandate came down from the government was that each VISN, there are 26 VISNs in the country, each VISN had to put a chiropractor in. And so in our VISN, which is VISN 2, Andy already filled that mandate, but because of the affiliation with the School of Medicine and Dentistry, but we don't really do anything dental, Mitch, we went and approached the clinic and said, hey, what do you think? Can we do this? And so they actually let us in. We were the first VA facility that was not mandated by the government to put a chiropractic clinic in. We started at 2 half-days. Per week, and it is now expanded to 4 full days per week. We also started a third site. Jason Napoli is running a third site in Bath, New York, and all of these started just because of the relationships that were built. And we also have, as Bart said, we have almost $2 million in funding now for randomized trials. And so we currently are seeing about 400 patients a month, about 100 a week. That is just between the Rochester and VA clinics. And I'm sorry, the Rochester and Canandaigua clinic. Jason sees another 40 or 60 patients a week. And so we see a fair number of patients. And we see anywhere from 3 to the most new patients we saw in a day was 9. But 9 new patients is a long day. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to go back and look at the patient characteristics, but we wanted to do it a little bit differently than Andy did because we wanted to kind of build on what Andy did. And so in our intake data, we actually had them do VAS. And I'm going to show this because we actually asked it in 3 different locations in 3 different ways to see if we would get different answers. And so I'm going to show you that data. We also used the ODI. And for the purpose of this, we only analyzed the physical subscale on the fear avoidance belief questionnaire. We did not analyze the work subscale because so many of our patients were not working. And so the other things that we looked at from the computerized patient record system, what's beautiful about working in the VA, and what's nice in regard to it being a training facility for students is this is a true electronic medical record, that everybody's records are in one location. So we can read what the behavioral health therapist is saying. We can read what their family physician's saying. We can read what the neurologist and the rheumatologist, and all the x-rays are there. So it truly is a true electronic medical record, which makes it very nice. So we wanted to go in and look at comorbidities, including PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anticoagulation status, the presence of osteoporosis, and also diabetes. And so our patients were pretty similar in age to Andy. The one thing I will say is remember that this was our first year, and that as with any clinic starting out, the referral patterns, the primary care physicians were a little bit nervous about us. They didn't know who we were. We really have grown in our relationship with them. And so I would say if we look now that our demographics would be slightly different. That I think we see younger kids. We're seeing more OEF and OIF vets coming back. And these kids are, well, that, I'll talk about that in a little bit. They're really good kids. They're pretty tall. Average weight was 210. I always say they didn't hire me because I was the smartest guy they could find. I was just the biggest guy they could find to move these patients around. And so Mitch actually agrees with that. That's it. Our BMI was 31. And so one of the nice things about this, again, as a training facility for our students, is that they get to learn on a big population and some very large guys who are tough to adjust. As you can bet, the almost 90% were men. We actually see more women than I thought we would. The most of them are white. And so not too different from what we would expect. This is actually some of the interesting data. What we did, and I'm going to admit the weakness of this slide going into it, we went in and the cover sheet of the electronic medical record has up in the left-hand corner a list. It's the problem list. And so what we did was we used that to determine the number of comorbidities. Now, there's a true weakness with that in that there are no objective criteria by which a problem gets added to the problem list, and there were significant redundancies in the problem list. And by the way, this was an incredibly time-consuming because this just had to be done. You had to go into every record and you had to hand count every single one so that you missed any kind of redundancy. But what I want you to appreciate, oh, Mitch, did you do that? Is almost all of them had multiple musculoskeletal comorbidities, but we also see a very significant number of cardiovascular comorbidities, including cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease. And what's nice, again, as a teaching tool, is that we don't have to talk to our kids about vascular claudication. They get to see it, neurogenic claudication. And so it really does make a great teaching environment. But we had significant numbers of other comorbidities. The other just kind of logistical thing that came from this is for any of you that have ever done any classification of comorbidities, there is no gold standard by which to do this. And so what we did was, and I'll admit the weakness of this also, we went into Harrison's textbook of medicine and we looked at what chapter in Harrison's that these topics were covered. The other problem comes when you classify comorbidities in that there's so much overlap. And so we included diabetes under endocrine, but certainly diabetic neuropathy, which is a complication of it, is included, and that certainly peripheral vascular disease, and so it became very complicated. But what I wanted you to appreciate from this slide is that this is a very comorbid population, which is a great teaching environment, but a complicating environment in regard to treatment. The complaints, most of our patients were low back, and 40% of those low back patients had lower extremity complaints, and we did this off of the pain drawing. Their initial pain drawing. 6.42 had stenosis. Again, you have to take that with a grain of salt. That's in the medical record. Not all of our patients have CTs or MRIs that we can do that. And as you also know, stenosis in and of itself doesn't mean anything. And so actually in our merit review grant, we're actually going to look at stenosis and do a sub-analysis of patients who have clinical diagnosis of stenosis. Neck pain was 11%. I'm sorry, neck pain 11% had upper extremity complaints. Not as many had headaches, but about 5% had headaches with their neck pain. This was the interesting one that I was, and glad Claire and Radio aren't here, so I won't get yelled at. But we asked them their verbal rating scale. So what we do is when the nurse brings the patient back, puts them on the scale and says, what's your pain today on a scale of 0 to 10? You write that down. Then we have a pain drawing that has a true visual analog scale, 100 millimeter visual analog scale, and so we have the mark on that. And then for those first 100 patients, we actually have since stopped using the quadruple VAS, but we were using the quadruple VAS. And that also asks, what is your pain right now? And it is interesting. You can see that there is some difference, but there was no statistically significant difference in how you asked it. But what we did find is that some patients, there is a significant difference in how you ask them. And so when we right now are waiting for funding to do the multivariate analysis, but when we go back and do the multivariate analysis, we want to see if those patients who have great variations also have some other psychological comorbidity or if it correlates with their fear avoidance belief score. So we're very interested in the psychosocial aspects of pain and their reporting of their pain. This was our ODI. You can see that it came right in at about moderate disability. But we have a pretty small percentage. About 10% came in at mild. About another 10% or 12% came in at moderate. And then you can see that we had kind of a smattering of severe on the ODI. Again, when we do our multivariate analysis, we're going to look at this and its correlation with fear avoidance belief score and also with their presence or absence of post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. And so those are things that we're going to be looking at as we go farther. These were our FABQ scores. They came in right about 11, but look at the standard deviation, 12.39. So there was a huge variation. Some of the vets, as you know, whenever you ask patients to fill out questionnaires, particularly these kind of questionnaires, you kind of are going to get a variety of responses, particularly if you have an open workers' comp, but in this case, if you have an open service connection claim going on. And so we're going to be analyzing that. But you can see that the majority fell kind of under, over 12 on the physical activity FABQ is considered some psychosocial overlay. And so we did have a fair percentage of that, but again, I think that what I want you to get from this slide is that there was a significant variation in their reporting on their FABQ. We also are working with a couple other people, actually in different locations. We want to do a study on the treatment of post-surgical backs, looking at the role of chiropractic at the area of previous surgery. So actually, if we looked at these numbers now, and we actually are going to be requesting IRB approval to look prospectively at our current post-surgical patients, but we have many more fusion patients now than we had then, but three of them had fusion. I think that the majority of those were 360 fusions, but it's interesting in the older population, you can see some old intertransverse fusions, non-instrumented anterior interbody fusions, and so you do see a variation. Most of them had LAMIs. One had IDAT. And IDAT actually isn't done much in the military, but in the Rochester area, we don't have anybody doing IDAT anymore. I think that the evidence on IDAT was slim enough that I don't think we're going to see that go on. Cervical fusion, cervical laminectomy. I've seen probably more cervical laminectomies working in the VA than I ever did in private practice. And it's interesting, multi-level posterior laminectomies, which there are all kinds of issues about. We see a significant number of carpal tunnel syndrome patients, and we do that because we developed a really good relationship with the neurologist who doesn't know what else to do with these carpal tunnel patients and ulnar entrapment patients. So we see a lot of those. And so one of the things that I'm very interested in and what we really are going to pursue, we have a current concept proposal in now, and we're going to be submitting a grant next year. We really want to look at the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder as a comorbid condition in chronic pain patients. And so what we know is that the general incidence of PTSD in the population is about 5 to 10%. But in the military, it can be up as far as 30%. And we see a significant, for any of you who read any of this stuff on PTSD and returning OEF and OIF veterans, it really is scary, and these are such good kids, and they come back with these chronic pain. In our cohort, we saw 23% of our patients had diagnosis of PTSD. Now, I'm going to qualify that and say that was a diagnosis that came from the chart. In order to diagnose PTSD, a trained behavioral health therapist has to make that diagnosis. And there's a whole series of things that happen within the VA. There's a screening, then there's a questionnaire, and then you have to have an hour-long interview with the behavioral health therapist. So actually in our randomized trial, we'll make sure that it's a real diagnosis of PTSD and not just from the chart. And so our hypothesis is that many of the PTSD patients suffer with comorbidities. And pain is the most common comorbidity in the PTSD population. And so we're very interested in looking at this in the future. We also are very interested in looking at depression and back pain. And you can see, again, that the literature does report that back pain and depression are comorbid conditions, and that it influences prognosis, and that your prognosis is poorer in the depressed patient. And so we actually, our grant will be an HSR&D grant. Our concept proposal is this, to develop a collaborative care model to have behavioral health and physical medicine and medicine working together on these patients, because we feel like we're beating our head against the wall so often in this population that we're treating these kids and that they're getting transient relief from what we do, but we've not addressed the underlying pathology, and we really feel like we could do a better job if we had a collaborative care model. We also wanted to start to look at safety. And from my work at Monroe Community Hospital, Coumadin becomes an issue, the anticoagulated patient. And we really only looked at Coumadin here. We did not look at antiplatelet therapy. So we did not look at Plavix, and we did not look at therapeutic aspirin. We also, in the future, we will look at INRs. But in this case, we just looked at patients who were on Coumadin. And what we're going to report is that, and what we are reporting is that there were no significant adverse events. And as you know, the study came out earlier this year in that lumbar epidural hematoma in an anticoagulated patient. And so we want to look at that. Osteoporosis, we really didn't expect to have a lot of osteoporotic patients. These are big men, and so osteoporosis is not as common. None of these patients did, none of these in our prospective stuff, we do have some T-scores, but we did not have T-scores on any of these patients. But there were no fractures or serious adverse events associated with spinal manipulation in this category, and that actually reflects our data that we reported on from Monroe Community Hospital also. And so, in conclusion, chiropractic services are new within the Veterans Affairs Clinic, and that it does seem to be somewhat different population. We feel like this is a really ripe teaching ground. We spend the end of the day, we spend anywhere from an hour to 2 hours sitting with the students and discussing the cases in a small group format. And really what's nice is that the students are much more open to hearing about things and learning when they've just seen the patient and when they're confused about these multiple comorbidities. And so it really does make a very nice teaching environment. We also, for our future, as I said, while our two randomized control trials really are looking at manipulation, my interest in the future really lies in a collaborative care model. I think that collaborative care is the treatment of the future, and that we want to see chiropractic at the table in this. And this is from behind my house. That was a double rainbow, but you can't see it very well. Thank you all very much.